Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Elizabeth Strout on family secrets, a dying Maine town, and her newest novel, The Burgess Boys. We'll also hear a very personal story. The diseases of the soul and spirit are difficult to diagnose and to heal. We're going to hear about a woman who found recovery in an altogether different source, a horse. But first, Russian classics behind bars. Books Behind Bars is a program which pairs undergraduates from the University of Virginia with inmates at the Beaumont Juvenile Correctional Center to read classic Russian literature. Prison staff noticed a marked change in behavior among inmates who take the class. Researchers have documented similar improvements in decision-making, social skills, and civic engagement among prisoners and undergraduates who participate in Books Behind Bars. Andy Kaufman is a lecturer and fellow and creator of the course. He recently received a $50,000 grant to expand the program to other prisons in Virginia and nationwide. Andy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Glad to be here.
So tell us about the first time you taught Russian literature inside of a prison.
It was in 2009. I was invited to teach actually Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Ilyich to a group of inmates at Virginia Beach Correctional Facility. This was part of a book festival. Had never been to a prison before, no idea what to expect. And so I prepared as I would for any normal class with lecture and questions. But the minute I walked into that classroom, I knew I was not in Kansas anymore because I distinctly remember the moment where I was wearing my Jose Banks suit, my burgundy penny loafers, and I walk into a room and there are 15 pairs of male eyes staring at me from above, identical orange jumpsuit. Mm. And I knew in that moment that what I had planned was not going to work.
What'd you do?
Well, I tossed my notes aside and I simply looked at these men and asked them a question. I said, what did reading this story mean to you? Mm. That was the beginning of an hour and a half long discussion, which is one of the most powerful classroom experiences I've ever had.
You then created Books Behind Bars, a course now so popular among undergraduates at UVA that 3/4 of the applicants get turned away. Tell us more about this course. I mean, do they read and study on parallel tracks with inmates or actually meet together?
So this is actually a course that is offered through the University of Virginia. It's a course that my University of Virginia students get credit for, but we actually go to Beaumont Juvenile Correctional Center. And the way it works is my students, after I prepare them for a month, they meet with residents at Beaumont. They work in pairs. My students work in pairs. They sit at about 8 tables, each table with 3 to 5 residents. And each pair of students facilitates a discussion for an hour and a half about a short classic of Russian literature that both they and the residents have prepared in advance. Students come up, they come up with the questions themselves, the creative activities. They have full autonomy to run these meetings.
I'm imagining a lot of firsts here. I mean, probably the first time reading Tolstoy or Dostoevsky for many of the residents, as you call them, maybe the first for college kids interacting in a prison setting. How do these respective groups benefit from those firsts and that relationship?
You know, we have a research project now through the UVA's Curry School of Education that's helping us really understand this. But one of the biggest firsts is that both groups actually bring their set of stereotypes about the other. My students, even if they didn't acknowledge it, had all sorts of stereotypes about what a juvenile delinquent is. And the residents had stereotypes about what college students are. And those stereotypes are utterly shattered pretty much by the end of the first meeting. My students see the residents as peers. These are kids who are the same age as them, who've made some bad decisions, but they're very bright, very creative, and many of them want to make something of their lives. And the residents look at my students as role models, as peers, not as teachers, but as people that took a different path in life and that they can emulate. The residents can emulate that.
Why do you think that Russian lit might be a key here? I mean, that could be the result of any kind of interaction.
That's true. It could be. And I, you know, love all national literatures, you know, from France and Germany. But there's something about Russian literature and the kinds of questions that it raises that really lends itself to the sorts of authentic, really deep conversations that the students and the residents have. Russian writers never looked at their role primarily as storytellers or entertainers or even as as social critics, primarily, they looked at their role as to help readers engage with some of life's most fundamental questions, you know, what they call the accursed questions of Russian literature. Who am I? Why am I here? And how should I live? So both groups sense this, that these are big questions that go beyond the social or the political events of the day and allow them to think about kind of fundamental questions of what they value in life and what they want and, you know, how they want to spend their time on this earth.
We're talking with Andy Kaufman. He's a UVA fellow and lecturer who created a course called Books Behind Bars. That pairs undergraduates with inmates at a Virginia juvenile correctional facility, and together they read and study classic Russian literature. Well, you mentioned that the Curry School is tracking, actually measuring improvements in the student population and also prison population. Prison officials use the course as a reward. How about after release? Any difference in recidivism rates, or do you stay in touch with kids who leave the program?
So we don't have the data on that yet, but I can tell you we're working on that. The program is run now for 4 years, so beginning next year we'll be in a good position to look at the five-year impact on both groups. But I can tell you we know that a number of the residents who have taken this class have decided that they want to go to college. And what's so powerful about that is that these are kids who never even considered college in their futures. Most of them had never even met a college student. One of them is already enrolled in college, who was in the program 2 years ago, and another one will be this fall.
I'm curious about the kinds of conversations that come up in classes. I mean, we know statistically that poverty, addiction, abuse often figures heavily into the stories of kids who end up incarcerated. How do they connect to 19th century stories of a culture that is so foreign from their own?
Well, I think they are surprised to find that the kinds of questions that these stories raise are questions that are as relevant today as they were in the 19th century. I mean, you referred to the death of Ivan Ilyich by Tolstoy, which is a harrowing story about a man who confronts the fact that he's dying and as a result starts to question how he's lived his life. Well, that story shakes up the residents in a very powerful way because many of them have had firsthand experience with watching family members die, watching friends die, and they've also had firsthand experience with making some very bad decisions in their lives. So this story allows them to talk about these very universal questions that really transcend time and place.
Andy, I'm wondering what people who advocate tough-on-crime sentencing and incarceration policies, I mean, there are many who criticize arts and prison programs as being cushy or less critical than learning skills rather than, you know, the moral vagaries of Dmitry Karamazov. What's your response to them?
My response is I think you need both. There already are skills-based programs and vocational programs. Some of them are successful, some are not. But the residents also need experiences which will help them go to college, help them get the kind of education that most Americans have access to and most of them do not. So any program that can help stimulate that within them, that can help teach them how to even begin to think like a college student, how to ask the kinds of questions and have the kinds of discussions that they might find in college, is not only a huge motivator, but it's really the beginning of a different trajectory for them.
You've been awarded this $50,000 grant by the University of Virginia to expand the program among students and possibly even other prisons. What do you think of using this kind of curriculum within an older prison population, the general prison population?
I am very intrigued by that idea. That's not our priority right now. However, there has been interest about that, and I think it would have equally powerful effect. The one difference would be that the prisoners will be older than my students, so there will be a different dynamic. Part of the power of the current model is that the residents, the inmates, and my students are the same age, which leads to some really powerful bonding and relationship building. But in general, I've taught Russian literature in a prison. I know it works, and it's very possible that this program, that would be a perfect venue for this program long-term as well.
Andy Kaufman, creator and lecturer behind the Books Behind Bars programs, as well as a Russian literature scholar and community engagement fellow at the University of Virginia. I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
You can read much more about the Books Behind Bars program at wordofmouthradio.org. In New York City, subway riders are awash in noise. The trains, the people, and the music. Buskers performing for crowds of commuters who often don't stop and listen. While everyone is going somewhere, one musician is staying still. Kathy Greer, also known as New York City Subway Girl, has made a sort of muse of the people who do stop and listen. They are the subjects of the Inspiration Project, which collects answers to the question, what inspires you?
What inspires me? Relationships between people.
People, heavy metal, cello, I don't know, all sorts of stuff.
Just the fact that the sun rises and it sets and there's a moon and the life keeps going round and round and it doesn't end, that to me is the biggest inspiration.
Kathy Greer, we welcome you to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, give us a little sense of being New York City Subway Girl. How long have you been doing it and where do you play?
Well, I've been doing it since 1999, so 14 years. And I love the stations, the terminals like Grand Central Terminal, Long Island Railroad. The reason for that is a little bit further away from the platform, so I'm not competing too much with subway car sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But I do enjoy playing on the platforms like Columbus Circle, which is like down and dirty, gritty brake sounds and craziness and collisions of sound meeting sound and sort of thriving where a lot of different train lines come together. Like Union Square is another one where I perform just above a platform, so kind of all over the place.
And so you watch all these people sort of passing by. Some of them stop, some of them don't. For the Inspiration Project, do people approach you first or do you go to them?
It's a fascinating thing. It was born because people were constantly stopping to talk with me and not feeling at all typical New York, not alarmed to say, oh, you're in the middle of a song, can I just start talking to you? Or they'd wait until my song was over and they'd come over and they'd start chatting. And I found that our conversations were so incredibly inspiring that I started bringing a little camera with me and asking if people would mind if I film them for my website. And I just say, what inspires you? And it's just so amazing what people have to say.
It really is something. I did note, though, you speak to a high school chorus at one point, and they all just say, music, music inspires me, music, music. I mean, how do you get people beyond that? How do you get them to say more?
You probably know that as someone that really believes in empowering people and that sort of idea of resonating and creating informed communities when you ask questions and you know how to sort of wait for answers. And I think if we live our lives where we are constantly thinking of the next question and never allow something to develop, other things are born. Other things aren't sort of nurtured and revealed. And so what I do is when I ask the question, if someone says music, like in the case of those amazing performing arts high school kids that really they stopped because I was jamming, singing a song Crazy with a Taiwanese film crew. And the kids started dancing around. And so I asked them to join in. And then I said, okay, so what inspires you? And I think they were doing that. I'm part of the group, music, music, music. And then I said, all right, if you had another thought, what would it be? Then other things are revealed. And one said piano and another said rap. And what I try to do when I ask the question is just allow that answer to formulate in whatever way that means. And sometimes it could be as brilliant as the intangibles, what you believe in that no one sees, or the organization of anti-chaos in nature and man. I mean, it's amazing what people say.
I wonder if it's made you think differently about all these people passing by you. I mean, all of them, if we saw the thought bubbles of what inspires them, would be so interesting.
I think it is a particular kind of person that commutes that allows for distraction, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I think somebody that's living in a very logistical, I am getting from point A to point B, I don't have time for this, they might just run by and pull an earbud out or a thumbs up or wave or smile or nothing. But I think there's a particular kind of person that kind of says, you know what, this is present. I'm in the present. I'm in the now. I'm in this moment, and I want to be a part of that. And so they linger, and in so lingering, I do eye contact. And in eye contact, that's suggesting a door opens. I think about Richie Havens, who just passed
away,
and
right?
Was a huge influence on my music. And in his obit, reading a statement that he said that really resonated with me, and he said, I'm not in the show business. I'm in the communications business.
Hmm.
So I feel like my role, and one of the reasons why I created NYC Subway Girl, is to remove myself from, hey, I'm Kathy Greer, the singer-songwriter, you got to go buy my music and see me as this artist. I'm part of that fabric of accepting the collision of sound meeting sound and creating a soundtrack and being part of that. So I think that opens up people to wander my way and chat.
Here's one of the guys who wandered your way. This is Joe Tucker. He was playing the cajon. Let's hear just a little bit of that because he played with you.
As a classical musician, no one ever asks me that question. They're like, what inspires you? Like, no, shut up, play this. This is Brahms. But it's true. If I don't practice for one day, I feel really uncomfortable. If I don't practice for two, I'm almost in like an anxiety attack. I have to play this stuff.
And now you've played
this
stuff.
I play it with you. Yeah.
That was really a lot of fun.
So what are you going to do with all of this, Kathy? You've collected all of these random people who stop, they communicate with you, they connect as you're talking about. What happens next?
Well, it's a lovely question, and I think living in a social media world and soundbite world and 140-character world and being a person that has really cared so much about creating informed communities and storytelling and being a troubadour, I think I'll keep it as a sort of ongoing series, the What's Your Inspiration Project or Inspiration Project. And from time to time, I collect them together and make a short film. I use it when I'm performing on an actual stage. So those that don't get a chance to go into the subway, somebody from afar might be able to watch more of a composite. It's kind of, you can hear the alarms outside, I think.
That's right.
I'm definitely in New York City. But I think that what I'd like to be able to do is continue with the idea of web series, maybe collectively put them all together to make one feature documentary eventually. But I like this sort of, almost in the way that a lot of writers did in the 19th century, which was installation. You know, you were talking about, in the previous caller, talking about Russian literature and Dostoevsky, who in a sense, he was putting out chapters, and then it came together as one book. And I think that that's where we're at today in the YouTube world.
Well, we'd love to keep watching, and I must ask you, what inspires you?
These kinds of conversations inspire me. I think getting out there, music inspires me. Being able to open my mouth and be able to sing with this gift, that's my inspiration.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Kathy Greer is known as the New York City Subway Girl and founder of the Inspiration Project. We'll leave you with Kathy playing above ground. Here she is. Now, this is doing a cover of Like a Rolling Stone. This is from Joe's Pub in New York City. We do have a link to find out more on the Inspiration Project. You can add your own. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out.
Coming up, can you treat traumatic brain injuries with theater? We're going to speak with two of the people behind a play that puts the invisible injury carried by so many combat veterans center stage. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a minute.
About how to be scrounging for your
word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. The novelist and former television producer Kate Wenner remembers the exact moment she decided to write a play about combat veterans with traumatic brain injury. She was filling her dishwasher while watching the news on TV. Here she is speaking to NPR's Daniel Zwerdling.
As I watched, there was this particular woman coming back from Iraq. I just remember she had a beautiful face, and her children were brought into the room, and she could not remember their names. And there was the metaphor for me. I mean, here was, in fact, the woman who has lost her memory, but it made me think about how all of us lose our memories when it comes to the consequences of the wars we fight.
Wenner went on to write Make Sure It's Me, which has been produced in Chicago, Colorado, and other communities around the country. After 2 months of related community discussions and events around this state, Make Sure It's Me is premiering in New Hampshire on June 1st at Portsmouth's West End Studio Theater. Leslie Pasternak is the show's director. She's also associate director of Act One. And Leslie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Three of the 10 actors in the production are former military, including retired U.S. Army Sergeant C.R. Marquis. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks for being here. Now, Leslie, you also heard Daniel Swerdling's report, apparently, on this play. What made you want to bring it to New Hampshire?
Well, I had been looking for some time for a theater production that would help bridge the divide I was perceiving between civilians and military in the community. So I had my ears open. Upon hearing it, we were really taken by the particular issue about traumatic brain injury, but also it seemed to serve really, really well for this larger idea of engaging civilians and military in our community together to talk about, well, we've been at war for many years now here, over a decade, and it's affecting all of us, but most of us don't even think about it from day to day. So we reached out within 24 hours, I think, of hearing that story and got to Kate Wenner right away, and she was delighted to have someone take a hold of the play and bring it through the full stage of production.
Well, what makes theater the venue for talking about this issue?
Well, it's interesting. Kate is primarily a novelist right now, but she spent 14 years as a producer for ABC's 2020, and she certainly had available to her when she first learned about this the ability to make a television program or a film. But she felt that she had been seeing a lot of things that were too easily turned off. We have a little bit of fatigue about that kind of story. And she said, if I write a play, small groups of people will be able to experience the stories at a time in the live presence of each other and have communication, conversation immediately after. Mm. And so one of the first things I decided was we're not just going to put on a play and after the show is over, people will say, let's go out for a drink and have some dessert. We're going to have a talk back after every single performance and we're going to give people the opportunity to ask questions, give us responses. So that's what we've been doing. So it's more than just a play. It's really a theater outreach event.
And CR, how did you get pulled into this?
I was doing a play in Portsmouth, and a friend of mine who I was working with brought it to my attention. They were looking for somebody to play a part of a soldier in the 30s, and I didn't want to do it. And she's like, "You're an idiot." So I showed up and I read the script and it was a great script. It was honest and it was raw and I couldn't turn it down.
What was your hesitation initially?
Well, there's a part of you that doesn't really want to kind of go there. You know, not having read the script, you just think that, okay, well, somebody's got an axe to grind somewhere. And there is no chip on anyone's shoulder anywhere in this script. Mm. And I've been sent scripts before for other projects where it's just they want to paint these military members as psychopaths or as just, you know, sociopaths, whatever. And that's not what was going on here.
We have indeed heard a lot, and we've had conversations on this program about, one, how difficult it is to diagnose TBIs accurately, and how difficult it is once you're diagnosed with TBI to keep track of one's own medicines. I mean, there have been accidental suicides. I mean, it's a big deal. Well, one thing I wonder, CR, is there a stigma about coming forward? Are there people that you know that have TBIs that probably haven't even been diagnosed?
I have friends that have TBI, PTSD, combinations. Not to the level that's demonstrated in the script, thankfully. I find this to be very fortunate. One of the problems is that it's a mental illness, and so you have to convince the person that they've got a problem. That can be hard because you make your money as a soldier on, you know, being self-reliant and knowing that you're competent and trusting your friends. And you, whether it's by luck or by skill, I think it's luck. You overcome some great odds and then you have this false sense of confidence. And so you don't necessarily want to reach out. You've got that wall. I've got a friend down in Florida. I won't say his name. But I know that he has both PTSD and he has traumatic brain injury. When he first went to see a doctor in Germany about the problems he was having with his memory and things, he asked the doctor what he thought was wrong with him. And the doctor says, "I don't know." He says, "Well, what do you think I can do to get help?" He said, "Go see a shaman."
No.
Yeah. Which is the wrong thing to say to this guy because that gave him fuel for days. And so, but he's down in Florida now and he takes notes and he's a smart guy, But I mean, he's limited by this TBI, and he's had to readjust.
Mm. Let's hear more from the play rehearsals for your production of Make Sure It's Me, the one that's coming to Portsmouth via Act One on June 1st at Portsmouth's West End Studio Theater.
I went to my CO because I was getting scared I was going to do something stupid, get hurt, worse, get somebody else hurt. CO flash blasts me in front of the whole company, saying I'm making up to stay on base. After that, everyone's calling me wuss, me, who used to be the go-to soldier.
One afternoon, our internet was running slow. I don't know what happened. I lost it. I started kicking everything, even our little mascot dog. I would have killed the little dog if my guys hadn't made me stop.
I got so depressed, I'd go out, wouldn't even load my weapon. They don't give the death money for a suicide, but I figured I got killed in the line of duty, at least I'd be worth something to my wife.
I'm speaking with Leslie Pasternak. She's director of Act One's production of Make Sure It's Me. That's a play about combat veterans suffering from traumatic brain injury, or TBI. Also with me is C.R. Marquis. He's retired U.S. Army sergeant. He's a member of the cast. Make Sure It's Me is making its New Hampshire premiere on June the 1st at Portsmouth's West End Studio Theater. Now, Leslie, do you know if Kate Winter actually got these statements from soldiers or from returning combat veterans?
Yes, almost everything that is included in the dialogue of the play is composite from interviews that she did for 9 months at at least two different locations around the United States, where she was talking to veterans, their loved ones, and caregivers, and really stitching together their own words. So particularly in these sequences that are the flashbacks on stuff, she is sharing actual turns of phrase and language and heartfelt sentiments. And where you ended that clip right there is for me one of the most devastating moments in the play. The idea of choosing to put yourself in the line of fire in order to have your life and death have some meaning for your family back home. Because, of course, let's remember another element of the quandary these veterans find themselves in is that this was not a draft. We have an all-volunteer army, armed forces, mm-hmm. inclusive of all the branches. Less than 1% of our population is in the military, and an even smaller piece of a percentage is actually going into combat. And so most of us don't know anyone who does. And often the attitude is, well, they knew what they were in for, they signed up. And yet we know that there are all kinds of things that can filter someone into making that choice. And for some people, like that character there, he tells you later in the play, I joined up because my wife was pregnant and I needed to do this financially. And so to have that kind of agonizing pressure that you must put yourself again and again in the line of fire, even when you know something is wrong, because that paycheck needs to go home, just devastating.
I'm wondering for you, CR, we're speaking to you just before Memorial Day weekend, and you know people are going to be celebrating their loved and lost and those who have served in the armed forces. I also read that tens of thousands of people are suffering from TBI and slipping through the cracks. And I wonder, you know, do people feel forgotten?
I think so. I think that it becomes very easy to fall into a rut where you just exist with problems, and with post-traumatic stress disorder, it becomes very easy to throw your hands in the air and say, well, I can't get in to see the VA, so I'm just going to give up trying. I think that the American public, mostly because of what the Vietnam veterans have gone through, I think there's far less of that. I think that this generation of American is more grateful. I'm happy about that. I wouldn't want to have to go back 30, 40 years and serve then. So I don't think that the American public forgets. I think the bureaucracy forgets. And I think that the American political machine doesn't care.
Well, that's quite an indictment.
It's the truth.
How about your role in helping people remember, putting this front and center in people's lives now, doing this play?
Well, that's kind of fun. because I am playing. I am doing what I love to do. Leslie has given me an outlet, and this has actually been pretty therapeutic for me. And the biggest help for me is when the veterans come up afterwards. And that's when I know I've got it right, is when the veterans come up or their family comes up and they're like, you got it right. That makes me feel really good.
I want to thank you for your service and for joining us today.
Thank you.
C.R. Markey, he is a retired U.S. Army sergeant. He is also one of the cast members of Make Sure It's Me. And Leslie Pasternak is director of Kate Winner's play, Make Sure It's Me, making its New Hampshire debut on June the 1st at Portsmouth West End Theater. Leslie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, the performance is free for Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans and their families. You can find out more about the production and more about TBI and how you can reserve tickets for Make Sure It's Me. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Now stay with us for Elizabeth Strout. She's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Olive Kittredge. We're going to talk with her about her new novel, The Burgess Boys, when Word of Mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Shirley Falls, Maine is one of those New England towns with a strong memory of the way things used to be before the mills closed, before the mall went up across the river, before so many residents moved away. It's the fictional town left behind by a pair of brothers in The Burgess Boys, a new novel by Elizabeth Strout, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for Olive Kittredge. The story centers on Jem and Bob Burgess, brothers whose lives are imprinted by a childhood tragedy in very different ways. Both pull up their stakes and secret miseries and move to New York City. And both are pulled back to their hometown by another family crisis. Elizabeth Strout joins us now from WPLN in Nashville with more. Elizabeth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, you set up the story for us in the prologue as a conversation between a woman and her mother, talking about what it was like observing these neighbors, the Burgesses. Tell us a little bit about this family.
Well, I thought with a prologue, the mother remains in Maine and the narrator, just for the prologue part, has moved to New York. And there was something that mirrored the situation of the Burgess brothers that I liked about that. So the mother and the grown daughter are just constantly sort of chatting and reminiscing about what the town was like back when the narrator still lived there. And that sort of appealed to me because I think we do that at times, you know, sit and just reminisce about what happened to the different people in our town.
Could you read a bit from that prologue?
Yes, I'll read the very last part. And so it began, like a cat's cradle connecting my mother to me and me to Shirley Falls. Bits of gossip and news and memories about the lives of the Burgess kids supported us. We reported and repeated. I told my mother again about the time I had come across Helen Burgess, Jim's wife, when they lived as I once did in the neighborhood of Park Slope in Brooklyn. My husband and I one night found ourselves dining near Helen and a friend in a Park Slope cafe, and we stopped near Helen's table as we were leaving. I'd had some wine, I suppose that's why I stopped, and I said to her that I'd come from the same town Jim had grown up in. Something happened to Helen's face that stayed with me. A look of quick fear seemed to pass over it. She asked my name and I told her, and she said Jim had never mentioned me. No, I was younger, I said. And then she arranged her cloth napkin with a little shake and said, I haven't been up there in years. Nice to meet you both. Bye-bye. My mother thought that Helen could have been friendlier that night. She came from money, remember, my mother said. She thinks she was better than someone from Maine. This sort of remark was when I had learned to let go. I no longer bothered myself with the defensiveness of my mother and her Maine. But after Susan Burgess's son did what he did, after the story about him had been in the newspapers, even in the New York Times and on television too, I said on the phone to my mother, I think I'm going to write the story of the Burgess kids. It's a good one, she agreed. People will say it's not nice to write about people I know. My mother was tired that night. She yawned. Well, you don't know them, she said. Nobody ever knows anyone.
So much said there. Elizabeth Strout reading from her new novel, The Burgess Boys. The Burgess Boys, of course, no longer boys, but kind of frozen in their roles as boys.
That's right.
And the fear that she sees on Helen Burgess's face, what do you think she's sensing there?
Well, Helen, you know, is aware that something bad seems to have affected her husband, Jim. And in typical Maine fashion, this earlier tragedy is simply never discussed by the family. In a different part of the country, that would be a different story. They would discuss it a lot. But in Maine, something happens early on or at any time, and it's not discussed. So Helen, the wife of Jim, doesn't fully understand the effect of all of this. She only knows that she's living with a husband. She loves him very much, and she of course, doesn't fully understand him as we don't ever really fully understand anybody.
Her husband, Jim, and his brother, Bob, and their sister, Susan, all in a car, which came out of gear on top of a hill and actually killed their father. All through...
When they were small.
When
right.
they were very small. So Bob, who was supposedly driving at this time, or remembers driving at this time, he is the one who's labeled as the boy who killed his father as they're
That's
growing
right.
up in Maine. Both Jim and Bob flee Maine to live in Park Slope, but are drawn back by this crime, this horrendous thing that you mentioned. Tell us what happened there.
Well, Susan, the sister that stayed in Maine because she wanted to, and that was her destiny, her son, quite out of the blue, threw a frozen pig's head through a mosque of some Somali refugees who had moved to town. And it's just a horrendous act. And the brothers are called upon to go back up to Maine and deal with this.
The crime was based on one that actually did happen in Lewiston, Maine, back in 2006.
That's right.
Some factual differences, however, it was done in the summer. You said it in the fall when Maine is full of Mainers, which I thought was significant. You know, the people from away have already gone home. You imagine this through the eyes of the police chief, through Somalis who live there, playing out in the DA's office. I'm wondering how you got all these different perspectives on this, Elizabeth.
The whole concept of it was very compelling to me, and I only do what I'm deeply interested in because the reader is not going to be interested if I'm not. And so I talked to an awful lot of people, and when that case actually did occur in real life, I followed it meticulously, and then I thought, well, novelistically, I can make some changes in terms of character, not in terms of what really happened as a society, how we deal to choose with an act like this. I talked to a lot of people and went up and spent time there and had myself a good old time. Making all this up around the reality of it.
We're speaking with the novelist Elizabeth Strout. She won the 2009 Pulitzer Prize for fiction for her book Olive Kittredge. We're talking about her newest book called The Burgess Boys. What happens after this horrendous act? Many in the town rise to the defense of the quote-unquote Somalians, but it also surfaces the kind of growing pains of a dying town. One character actually
Absolutely.
Says that the town is on life support. So what does this Somali population bring to Little Shirley Falls, Maine?
Well, hopefully they bring a lot. This is a town, as many towns are in Maine and elsewhere throughout the country. This is a town that lost for, you know, about 30 years ago their textile mills, and the Somali population is very entrepreneurial, and they hopefully are bringing in a potentially new activity in life and some businesses and all sorts of things. But of course, Maine is the whitest state of the 50. It is the oldest state of the 50. So there is, as people say, a situation up there.
And their sister, Susan, she's left behind, but not only by her brothers who moved on, but by her husband.
Yeah.
Tell us
yeah.
a little bit more about her as a character, the one who stayed behind.
Right. Well, Susan's had some blows. Her husband did leave, and she's raised this child who was never exactly right. He's sort of, poor Zach seemed to suffer from that kind of failure to thrive kind of syndrome. He's always been a little bit of an odd duck, and Susan loves him deeply, but of course is vastly confused as to why he should do this and feels very protective of him and yet obviously horrified at what has happened. And she feels separated from her brothers because they went and left, and they have a very different lifestyle in Maine. But by the end of the book, all three of these grown children, these grown siblings, have kind of shifted position and have made, I think, significant motions forward in their lives, even if it appears that they go through some bumps on the way.
There seems to be a parallel between her need for help and company and the refugees who've arrived in town, sort of lost and adrift, although she has a community there. But she feels this resentment that, you know, they get attention, that they get help, and she has none. So what's going on here? It's not just the economics of a community, but a social fabric of a community. It's sort of an evolution. What's going on there?
There are many different reactions to this population moving into town. And as she says, you know, liberals love a good cause. And so there are certain people that jump forward to help. And then there's that marvelous backing of the Somalis, you know, support of the Somalis after this act happens. But Susan has never really understood them, has never had any interaction with them, which is very typical, frankly. There are a lot of people in these communities that remain completely oblivious to the problems that the Somali refugees are having. So a lot of things are going on. And there are many parallels. As you said, there's one, you know, with Susan and her situation and the Somalis and their situation. But there are a lot of parallels. The concept, even the boys the men, mm-hmm. Jim and Bob, who have moved to New York. I mean, what is home? How do you go about reinventing yourself? And how do you go about moving to a new environment and making it feel like it could be home?
You left Maine behind, too, didn't you?
I did.
So does
well,
that?
Well, sort of.
But is that a betrayal? You know, the way you describe it in the beginning, in the prologue, with the woman talking with her mother. You know, she's somehow disloyal for leaving Maine.
Yeah.
Do you feel that?
Well, I think at the time that, you know, I'm 57 years old and I left when I was about 23. So at that time, I think there was a sense of betrayal, might be too hard a word, but I think there was a sense of, you know, what's wrong with staying where all your ancestors, you know, 10 generations of your ancestors have been here? What's wrong with this beautiful state and why do you have to leave? I think now people understand that a lot of young people have to leave Maine because economically they simply can't stay there. But at the time that I left, there was, I think, a sense of betrayal, certainly.
Elizabeth Stroud, I'm just wondering, you know, how after winning a Pulitzer Prize, you inevitably are going to be compared to your previous book. How do you begin again? How do you shut that off in your head and just write and produce a new work?
I think about the characters. That's what, as long as I'm fully in the work, I'm fine. It's when I picked my head up and I thought, oh my goodness, I have all these new readers and I want to be responsible to them. You know, I don't want to let them down because they had joined me. But it's something that only went through my mind because I was really just, you know, I'm working. I'm inside the work.
And we're glad for that. Thank you so much. Pulitzer Prize winning writer Elizabeth Stroud. Thank you. Her newest book is called The Burgess Boys, and you can find more on the novel and on her award-winning book, Olive Kittredge. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Animals have long played a part in human therapy and healing, from dogs trained to assist the disabled to all manner of animals making visits to hospitals and nursing homes. Sean Hurley brings us the story of a Vermont woman who bore the invisible scars of emotional and physical abuse and found healing with a horse.
Before you get to the Rocky Ridge Farm and Chester the horse and Sharon the person, you have to pass the black turned soil of the Lemax Farm and Clay Hill Farm, whose hill cannot be spied, nor its clay scented. Up the long dirt driveway, the chickens meet you first, and then Pepper the dog, and then Sharon Miller Blake.
So this is Rocky Ridge Farm, and that is the handsome Chester up there, sticking his head out of his window.
Chester the horse peers out the picture window of his red-painted double stall. All around him, huts and little houses dot the bowl of the land. Although Sharon has been writing in journals most of her life, she never once considered writing a book. And as she describes it, the book she's just published began as a kind of letter to a suffering friend that got out of hand.
I wanted to share the background of my life with a few people, especially one person who I knew at church. And I started writing it down. And then I felt compelled to keep writing.
The memoir, On Horseback and Healing, details Sharon's long history of abuse and her even longer history of healing, much of it recent and a lot of it due to her relationship with Chester. Sharon says the moment she saw the horse, she felt a shift.
It was like seeing myself in him. It was like we chose each other when I first met him. And we chose each other, I think, because we were both had very, very traumatic past. We still had a lot of spirit, a lot of fight in us.
Chester is a white, soft chestnut gelding, scarred across the brow and ribs. His own history of abuse means he doesn't much care for men, as his early male handlers used to beat him.
This dent has to have been a 2x4 when he was very hard to break and probably fought against being trained.
Sharon's connection to Chester wasn't and isn't sympathy or empathy primarily, but more like identification. To care for the dangerous, ill-used horse was to care for herself, something she's had trouble with her whole life.
I was born of a 45-year-old woman, definitely unwanted. My father was a violent alcoholic. When he found out Mom was pregnant with me, he dragged her down the stairs by her hair.
Her mother tried to give her away when she was first born, and Sharon's childhood never brightened.
My mom took Valiums, which her doctor prescribed for her. But she would take her Valium and go to her room and totally close her eyes and her mind to what was happening to us, the kids.
It was one trauma from violence, another from lovelessness, and a third from the sexual abuse she suffered at the hands of an itinerant farmer who boarded with the family.
I just felt like I must be bad. And that was the other big thing that came out of the sexual abuse, is that he said, "Don't tell anybody or we'll get in trouble." He made me feel like I was guilty, just as guilty as him, and I should be ashamed.
Over the years, Sharon has tried different therapies on and off, but Chester therapy seems to work best.
Sensory therapies, horse therapies, nonverbal therapy is a more direct type of therapy for me. For me, a lot of times words get in the way.
And yet the writing of the book, this particular set of words, was also healing. While she was keen not to bludgeon the reader with too many details, the dark parts aren't skipped. With the book, Sharon wanted to tell anyone who'd started out life as she had that they can make it back. And the more joyous parts of the book are handled in a language full of grace and almost stand as proof of her return.
And sometimes I'm asked, why did it take 42 years to get around to that point? And I say, well, spiritual healing takes its own time.
The injured rider rides an injured horse, but whatever's injured doesn't matter for the riding.
And he and I are quite a pair. I think we're both empowering and healing for each other.
And wherever Chester rides, Sharon goes too. And whatever Sharon finds, Chester finds too.
The meadowlark and the chimtree and the sparrow.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Set to the sky in a flying spree for the sport of the pharaoh.
Thank you for spending some time with us today. If you did miss any of the program, or if you'd like to share what you heard with a friend, wordofmouthradio.org has a brimming menu of past shows from our archives and easy links to post segments on social media or to forward them to friends. And we, of course, welcome your comments and your contributions. You can send an email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org. You can post on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again to hear more of what's bubbling up on Word of Mouth. from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
and Bill Barry.
And senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
With plenty of help from our awesome intern,
Logan Shannon.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program
are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast
and listen to past shows, go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr.
Follow us on Twitter.
And check out a playlist of music from the program
on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.
We've seen